What's up, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, Digital Shadow's weekly threat intelligence podcast. I'm your host today, and with me I have Charles, Alec, and Rick Holland. How are y'all doing today?
Hey, pretty good.
How's it going?
Doing really well.
Really well. I love that. That makes me happy to hear.
Because it's Friday. It's really Thursday, but when this gets published, it'll be Friday.
It's Friday for the listeners, but right now it's Thursday and I still have those Friday feels, so I'm just trying to push through the rest of the week. All right, well, we have quite a few topics lined up today, so let's go ahead and get started. Charles, I'm actually going to start with you. So we've learned that researchers have some mixed thoughts on sanctions for ransomware negotiations. Can you kind of give us a message or what the message was from the Department of Treasury that we just recently received?
Yeah, so it's actually, I think, one of the reasons a lot of people are feeling kind of iffy about it in general, myself included, is the language is vague, because it's just the actual statement from the Treasury Department was that if you engage in this, then you may be faced with sanctions. So if you do pay ransomware operators or negotiate that, then you may be faced with sanctions. So there's not like a definitive, like they're going to do it or not. And so there's kind of seems to be some leeway. And then, I mean, it kind of also just goes into the effectiveness of sanctions against cybercrime groups in the first place. Some of the groups they've added to this are some of the bigger, you know, well-known groups that we've covered here in the past, like Evil Corp, Lazarus Group, the SamSam ransomware group, like those kind of are the big names. And I think it's very difficult to come up with an effective means of sanctioning individuals like that, you know, when they're not at the state level, and to be able to enforce that against companies as well. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with this kind of, that's my opinion on why a lot of people are having some mixed feelings about this. I know, Rick, you said recently you had some ideas about that. Did you have anything you wanted to expand on?
Yeah, I mean, ransomware still continues to be such a hot topic of discussion. I remember earlier this year when the IC3, the Internet Crimes Complaint Center report from the FBI came out, it was the first time that I had seen the FBI use language around, instead of saying don't pay ransoms, that they understood and recognized that some companies would pay ransoms. So that was interesting. Now this guidance, you know, for me, I'm not a lawyer, don't play one on TV, but I would think that company, you know, talk about, we always talk about planning for failure, doing tabletop exercises. You should definitely work with your inside counsel and find out who the right outside counsel. Somehow, I think after that guidance came out, what was it, last Thursday or Wednesday? I can't remember the exact time frame. There's probably a lot of inquiries going into some of these outside counsel firms that specialize in this area. I do think whenever there is gray and ambiguous guidance given, there's loopholes that people can find and work around. But I think the main thing is, it would be good now is to find out and get some outside counsel and what their guidance is going to be there. And you know, it did make a comment that even if you are unaware that a ransom operator was from a sanctioned country, let's say North Korea, right? You could still be responsible for it. So I think this is one where definitely talk to the lawyers. And you know, we've also seen, I think it was someone at Mandiant or FireEye was saying that they had seen ransoms of what, 10 to 30 million, ransom payments of $10 to $30 million range, which is, you know, astounding there. And I think you still have the ethical conversations around, you know, are you fueling and incentivizing cyber criminals and extortionists, which I think is an easy thing to say if you're sitting in the sidelines eating popcorn. But when you get extorted yourself and you have to make a decision or your business could go out of business, that's a whole different one. So, you know, again, best thing, like we always say, is have these conversations in advance, know who to talk to from an incident response perspective, know who you need to talk to with your insurer, know who to talk to from outside counsel perspective. So it makes any decisions around extortion a little bit less painful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's just a huge thing, is again, like that goes into that whole business continuity planning and disaster recovery stuff that you just talked about. And I just think that's something that a lot of people don't take into account when they end up being the victim. So,
yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, not necessarily large businesses but some of them, and, you know, many small and medium sized businesses, their security, I suppose, posture isn't as great as it possibly could be. And that's for a multitude of reasons, but especially if you don't have backups and you suddenly have ransomware spreading through your network. I mean, what would you really focus on? Would you be focusing on getting your files back, or would you be, I mean, there's so much to consider here. So the sanctions, I mean, it's definitely interesting to see what might happen in the future. And actually, on the topic of cryptocurrency and extortion, we actually had a new blog come out this past week that's really interesting. It details the ins and outs of Bitcoin versus Monero and how Monero is kind of losing its anonymization factors slowly but surely. If anyone's interested in that, please take a look at it. It will be in our show notes. On to the next topic. So, Alec, I want to chat with you about this one. APT 28 has been associated with intrusion activity against the U.S. federal government. That's some pretty big deal stuff. So can you kind of tell us what happened there?
Yeah, definitely. Good old Fancy Bears back at it again. So a CISA alert was, when did that go out? It went out on the 24th of September. So not too long ago. Their intrusion detection system that's named Einstein, is tasked with monitoring the federal civilian networks. So Einstein identified a potential compromise of a federal agency's network. So they don't name what federal agency in particular. They just say that it's any or a federal agency. So for any Among Us fans out there, this hit the red button. They said that this activity looked mad sus and resulted in an emergency meeting.
It's quality. That's quality reference right there. Quality.
And this
reference
is way over my head. I'm mostly appreciating how you attempted to assign a pronoun to Einstein.
Yeah, sorry. I went back there.
I really enjoy just like the naming scheme for a lot of the stuff. I mean, who comes up like Operation Glowing Symphony? You know, like Einstein for this. Like those
you think
just like
Einstein and IBM's Watson are friends?
Ooh.
They really missed the opportunity for naming it Sherlock.
Well, anyways, back to APT 28.
It's like, come on, y'all can do better.
Sorry.
So yeah, back to APT 28. So they saw this malicious activity. They conducted incident response and confirmed that the malicious activity was indeed malicious. So good job to Einstein there. And yeah, that's kind of like the basis of what happened.
Cool, right on. So generally throughout the report that we were reading up on, they use very specific methods, or the intruders use very specific methods to access systems and further conduct their accounts. So can you give us a rundown of what they used?
Yeah. So the CISA alert does a really good job of mapping their entire, the threat actor's movements to MITRE ATT&CK. And it's really interesting if you have the time to go take a look there, but just kind of give you the overview of the picture of it. So their initial access was gained through legitimate credentials. They didn't know how those credentials were sourced. So they mentioned that it could have been from the Pulse Secure VPN vulnerability that we've talked about a couple of times. So those legitimate credentials gave them access to Microsoft Office 365 accounts and domain administrator accounts. And so with the admin access, they really just started poking around, really started enumerating as much as they could, enumerated Active Directory, the entire network, and then changed the registry key within the group policy. They went on to create a secure shell tunnel for themselves and a local account and really just had a free reign. They just played around and avoided detection with some pretty cool persistence techniques that we've seen historically from APT 28.
I mean, honestly, just thinking about this scenario, this is really scary, especially coming from a practitioner or a defender standpoint. I mean, all of these things like dropping a secure shell and going through Active Directory and changing those things up, like that's a nightmare. So, I mean, especially considering that it was within a federal government entity, even scarier. But they said that they mentioned that this was APT 28 or Fancy Bear. So how did they determine that or attribute this attack to that group?
Yeah, so they really just based it off of some overlapping infrastructure that they've seen historically used by APT 28. Additionally, the timeline of the attack or the timeline of the activity aligned with some other reporting that CISA put out beginning of the year. And so it just kind of lined up. You know, if it quacks like a duck, if it looks like a duck, then it's probably a duck. So here, in this case, maybe if it growls like a bear and looks like a bear, then it's probably APT-28.
Oh, wow. You're on fuego today.
I like it.
If it wears a monocle and drinks tea and looks like a bear, then it's Fancy Bear. Okay, cool. And so on to another topic, kind of talking about anonymization. We've read a report that foreign spies are using front companies to disguise their hacking, also borrowing an old camouflage tactic. So this is something that's really interesting. I mean, it kind of goes to the saying that things will change over time, but some things never really do change. They found that foreign spies kind of took a page out of the old book, and they set up a front company to disguise their cyber espionage campaigns. It was actually through if you can see my air quotes right now, a legitimate penetration testing business, and that was named Chengdu 404. I was kind of curious, and I looked up the translation, and it actually, Chengdu translates from Chinese to English as become a capital 404, so not really sure what that means, but it's definitely kind of interesting to me. So basically in the scenario, based on an unsealed indictment, 5 Chinese men and 2 Malaysian nationals were charged by the Justice Department. So really, it seems that their efforts weren't as bulletproof as they had probably hoped. But through their nefarious work, the group allegedly gained an estimated $1 billion by posing as the cybersecurity firm. Throughout their attacks, they used phishing and other penetration testing methods, and they compromised more than 100 organizations out of US, South Korea, and Japan. Throughout their attacks, they also compromised software, which was like ASUS, CCleaner, and NetSurang with malware. And then they also gained access to source code, app signing certificates, and then PII, or personally identifiable information. So all really heavy hitting stuff, lots of money, but now they've been found. So at the end of the day, the operation was actually attributed by security firms to APT-41, which is an alleged Chinese cyber espionage unit, and that's believed to be affiliated with the Ministry of State Security. So what are y'all's thoughts on this one? I mean, we have seen front companies covering for espionage operations or just criminal operations in general. What's y'all's take on this one?
It kind of brings back to mind the cuckoo's egg story that we discussed before in a previous podcast. I mean, kind of the whole general thing there was that there was some like East German hackers using like legitimate company infrastructure and stuff to kind of carry out things on behalf of like various government actors, kind of using that stuff as a cutout, I guess. So it kind of reminds me of that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I find it pretty interesting that they were impersonating a legitimate penetration testing company. So that's pretty cool, because obviously then it's going to give them access to do a lot of things or request information that makes them seem legit and what they're doing, but in fact it wasn't. So it's pretty cool that they're using that as a guise.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good front. If you're going to have one, why not have a penetration testing firm? Sounds like a plan to me.
Exactly.
All right, cool. So rolling on into our very last topic of the day, Charles and Alec wanted to talk to you guys specifically about this one. So there's an Iranian nation state threat actors that have been leveraging the zero log on flaw, which is super scary in and of itself. But what was Microsoft's warning?
So basically like zero log on, it's been talked about extensively, but basically it's like a there's an issue with the way that like the net log on remote protocol works. And so now that there's a proof of concept in the wild, people are able to like wipe passwords on domain controllers or just authenticate without any issues, connect unauthenticated, stuff like that. So that's the big issue. And this is being exploited in the wild. And some of the problem is like that you have people out there with this public exploit that are using that to wipe those passwords, even if it's on accident on a machine they're trying to get access to. And that can just kind of be disastrous. And sometimes there's been a lot of people reporting now when they roll back to kind of fix the issue to a previous update and stuff that even after the exploit has been ran, that there's been a ton of issues, errors, bugs, things like that. And so the issue has been patched, but I think Alec has a little bit more to talk about kind of as some more of the other stuff going on with it.
Yeah. So I'll go over a little bit about Mercury and Muddy Water, just kind of the threat intelligence side of that. So Microsoft calls Muddy Water, they're more commonly known as Muddy Water, but Microsoft calls them Mercury. Historically targeted government victims in the Middle East, espionage type of activity. They're associated to Iranian nation state. So yeah, I mean, obviously, as Charles alluded to, the information that they could obtain in exploiting this vulnerability, it's obvious why a threat actor that's interested, I mean, why any threat actor would be interested in exploiting the vulnerability, but particularly a threat actor that's interested in leveraging information or, you know, that espionage type of thing, that this is going to be something that would give them access to what they're trying to find, information they're looking for. So it's kind of expected activity for Muddy Water to go ahead and start targeting this vulnerability, especially now that there's a proof of concept that's already out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with the proof of concept, I mean, anytime a vulnerability drops, I'm always looking for a proof of concept to see if there's anything out in the wild that could be used and then make this vulnerability even more worse than it already is. So yeah, like you mentioned, since it's already out there, it sounds pretty bad. But I guess in the meantime, specifically with Mercury or Muddy Water, generally what kind of methods do they use and what are they using now?
Yeah, so they've pretty consistently used living off the land techniques, again, as you would expect from somebody who would want to maintain that persistence on a network and just attempt to gain as much information as possible. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the main characteristics is the leverage of those living off the land techniques and maintaining persistence on victim networks.
Yeah, right on. Cool.
One thing that everyone should be aware of now is that we are in Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We're going to be putting out a lot of content over the coming weeks, lining up with the topics for the month. My joke about this month is the only month that you actually have to care about cybersecurity awareness, which is obviously not true. We should be doing that all the time. One thing I would point out that I just did, and it just came out on Thursday, was I did a Bright Talk panel on protecting connected devices from cyber threats, which is one of the topics for Cybersecurity Awareness Month. But it was a good conversation on the panel. We had the CISO of Thycotic that moderated it for us. But one of the things I talked about was the attack surface of connected devices. I focused a lot on attack surface for, you know, the consumer grade IoT that we have at home. I also talked about using connected devices as you're doing VIP assessments for your high value targets and how they may be targeted.
All right. Thanks for that, Rick. Really appreciate it. So in the meantime, we kind of wanted to bring our old tradition back, kind of with a funny, weird off topic segment, kind of pulling back from what we did 2 weeks ago. What is your favorite candy specific to Halloween, I guess?
Reese's peanut butter cups.
So is that like a year round thing or is this specific to the season?
I mean, I don't really eat that much candy.
Yeah.
Unless it's like here in the house for Halloween and we get ready to put it out. And then my wife usually has to stop me from eating all the Reese's before we put it out. So
one suggestion I would have, listeners, this may or may not have happened to me. Don't go to Costco and buy a giant bag that includes Reese's peanut butter cups 2 weeks before Halloween. It will not end well.
It didn't last, did it?
No, it did not make it to Halloween.
Yeah, same thing happened here. Yeah, I'm going to have to go with probably Snickers, man. I love me some Snickers.
Solid.
Alec?
I'm on Team Charles, Reese's fan as well.
I feel you.
That's actually my favorite candy, but I like the next level ones. So Reese's peanut butter cups with the Reese's pieces inside. So you get a little crunch inside the peanut butter. I'm a fan of that. Although my favorite candy overall is Twizzlers, but I don't like Halloween Twizzlers because you have them individually wrapped and it's like one at a time. Like I'd rather just inhale an entire bag, you know, like five or six little pieces at a time versus, you know, taking an hour to pull the little piece out of the wrapper.
Man, I love black licorice. It's like, it's so good.
Yeah,
that's
probably
one of my favorite year-round candies, especially that candy that Alec brought to the office. That was like that finish.
Oh, like, it was gross.
Oh my god, I ate most of that jar. So,
So, okay, if I remember this correctly, you were one of the weirdos that was eating the black licorice, like the salted black licorice that someone brought in?
Yeah.
Charles, I think from this point forward, we're just going to have a working relationship. We're not going out to happy hour or anything like that, because this just sounds immoral. And then, Alex, so which candy was it that your son said that he was no longer going to be friends with you because you didn't buy it for him?
So it really wasn't a candy. I think it was like this toy that was...
Okay.
Yeah, it was like a splat ball. So it's like this just snot-looking ball that would just get absolutely dirty and disgusting within a day of me buying it. So yeah, had that good long fight yesterday.
Oh man. All right. Well, I guess that should probably do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining me, Charles, Alec, and Rick. It was a good time. Thanks for tuning in, listeners. Y'all have a good week, and we'll chat with you next time.